welcome to this NoFibs podcast. In this episode, we present the Candidates Forum in Benalla, recorded on the 26th of April. Benalla is in the seat of Indi, currently held by Independent Helen Haynes. We hope you enjoy this episode.
I'll officially welcome you with my language is Yakamadora Bangarang Waka, which means welcome to Bangarang country. But I'll extend it by saying Yakama use Bangarang Walla. So you, in Bangarang language, that means you're also welcome to use Bangarang water. So I'll finish with the ditch, but thank you very much for Sue, for extending the invitation for me to come and provide the welcome to country for you. It's such an honour for me to be able to stand in front of you and give homage to my people and our culture. But our culture also belongs to yous right now, and it also belongs to your grandkids, grandkids, grandkids. So eventually we're working towards together to be a one Australia, no more you and us. But in saying that, thank you. I'll finish with the sound of the ditch for you.
Explain to you the proceedings for this evening. I am a very strict timekeeper, so I will be timing each of the candidates' introduction. They have 2 minutes, and I'll give you a 30-second warning, and I will intervene if you go over 2 minutes. Not necessarily assertively. After that, we have taken questions in writing, and we have literally had a few hundred questions. It's just staggering. So our volunteers have worked through and grouped them into topics and then have given me the most frequently asked questions within that topic. So I will be going through what they've arranged, and each candidate will have 90 seconds to give their response to that question. Now, in my experience, it goes much more quickly than you expect. So we may not be able to cover as many topics as one would like, but that is just the reality of the time constraints that we have here this evening. We're going to introduce our candidates in alphabetical order. We have 7 of the 10 candidates here this evening, and because it's alphabetical order, our first candidate to speak for 2 minutes is Nadia David from the Australian Labor Party.
Good evening. I am Nadia David from the Labor Party. I'd like to acknowledge Uncle for an amazing welcome to country. That was, it's something that we need to be constantly reminded of, that we're on unceded land and that this is land that we've taken and it was never given. So I am from Beechworth. I'm actually originally from Tasmania, but I now live in Beechworth. We have a little farm there where we breed Australian stock horses. My husband, Charles, and my 2 kids, Ben and Elena. We've lived there since 2016. We moved down from Canberra. Yes, we are Canberra escapees. I've worked in federal government for 8 years before that, so I had a fair bit of experience in the Attorney General's Department and worked across task forces like the Defence Abuse Response Task Force and in the National Human Rights Commission, the National Human Rights Consultation around Australia. So I've had a fair bit of experience in federal government, and I've done a fair bit of work in community. I'm also a unionist. So I am the I'm the NTU delegate in RMIT, and my focus for running INDI for Labor is about equality. It's about making sure that we are providing the services we should as a government, making sure that things get done here, making sure that people have what they need here, and things are, and we're not getting in the way of things that they can be doing. Labor is a party of women in government. It is a party of young people. So I'm doing this also because I believe in climate action, and I really want to see a lot more of that happen. I decided to run during Black Summer, and I'm sure all of us here have an understanding of what that was like. So thank you so much, and it's amazing to see so many of you here. Thank you for coming.
I do like someone who runs to time. Now, our second candidate is Julian Finch from the Liberal Democratic Party.
Thank you very much, and thank you for coming out tonight. It's good to see people participating in our democracy and in this election. I'm standing for the Liberal Democrats. Now, the Liberal Democrats are an in-between sort of party. We're not ideologically to the left, and we're not ideologically to the right. We're sort of in the middle, and our policies are based on facts and figures and desire to do the best for the people in INDI. And all of these people here are here to do the best for INDI. So some of the things that the Liberal Democrats believe in are personal freedoms. And personal freedoms are things like we would not have a vaccine mandate. We believe in smaller government, and we believe in less taxation. There are particular problems that we would like to address, like climate change, and we would like to abolish the prohibition on nuclear power. I'm sure that many of you know we already have a nuclear reactor in Australia, in Sydney. And that's where we get our medical isotopes for doing nuclear imaging investigations. And we would like to extend that and trial or pilot nuclear energy in Australia, because we think that it is the safest, cleanest and cheapest form of energy, baseload energy, that is available in Australia. I'm a local farmer. We've been farming up near Wangaratta for about 40 years. I have a medical practice in Wangaratta, and I live on the family farm with my wife and two children. I'm a lieutenant in my local CFA, and I turn out to fires, and I consider myself to be a fairly active part of the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Julian. Now, candidate number three, Liz Fisher from the Nationals.
I'd like to acknowledge the Bangarang Nation, and thanks for a lovely welcome to country. Thanks also for emceeing, Libby. So I'm Liz Fisher. I am one of 10, and I grew up in Inverloch. So I grew up in regional Victoria. Like most people, I moved to the city for university. That was after spending a year in Japan, fully immersed in rural Japan. After completing my degree in business, I've worked for corporates, so I understand how corporate businesses work, such as GE, Optus, Yellow Pages. Following that, I made the move to the northeast of Victoria, and I worked in regional development. So I really understand how the grants program works. I understand how to make partnerships at community, local, state and federal level, and how to get projects across the line to get investment in this area, and I've got a track record for that. Following that, I became a farmer, and I'm a farmer in my own right, who happens to be married to a farmer also. Since starting our business, we've more than tripled it, so we know how to run a really good business. In addition to that, I've always been active in the community since I was a teenager, and that's from volunteering, you know, in the library, volunteering in netball, volunteering in, you know, I was the president of the playgroup, president of the kindergarten, where I got a capital grant to expand the kindergarten, I'm currently coaching the under-15s, which is, you know, 15-year-old girls. So, you know, what that means is I'm someone that is like you. I have three girls. I'm active in the community. I work really hard. My husband says you make your own luck. So people that were successful overnight were not successful overnight. They were successful because they worked hard and they made their own luck. And the thing I most appreciate about being a candidate is giving you all a choice. And I thank all these candidates for being here today, because by them... Thank you.
Our fourth candidate is Benjamin Gilbert from the Greens.
You can really play the didge. How healing is live music? We'd feel a want for that. My name's Benjamin Gilbert. I'm a sculptor in Yakandanda. This is my first time. I have a company, a couple of companies actually. We make civic sculpture and playgrounds. We've got a really good one in Benalla. I didn't do it. One of the last remaining rocket ships. I'm standing for the Greens because I have to look my kids in the eye. And we have a climate crisis, and everyone here, this is available, it's being recorded, everyone here that isn't standing for doing justice to climate, your children are going to resent you. Your grandchildren are going to resent you as well. Okay? Be very mindful of what you leave as a legacy. I wasn't meaning to preach, sorry. People probably know I've made a house.
1 minute.
I'm not in a rush. The Greens have costed policies. We should all be the richest people on the planet. If we weren't selling off our resources without value adding them, we have the smarts. We've been at the forefront of solar research for 29 out of the last 30 years. We've got nothing to show for it. Australia can export green steel, green hydrogen, and electricity much cheaper than we have it now. The problem is it's run by a small bunch of people, and you're all paying for it. The billionaires, the large corporations are dominating what your children are able to do with their lives, and you need to reclaim that back. I haven't spoken very well, but hopefully my intentions are felt. Thank you.
Thank you, Benjamin. Now to our fifth candidate, Helen Haynes, independent.
Thank you so much, Libby. Thank you very much, Joseph, for that beautiful welcome to country. I'd like to pay my respects to Aboriginal elders, past and present, and any Aboriginal people here today. Thank you, Libby, for hosting tonight. Thank you, Benalla, for putting this on. It's fantastic to see you, and I want to thank my fellow candidates as well. So, I'm Helen Haynes, proudly independent federal member for Indi. Prior to coming to Parliament in 2019, I spent 30 years working clinically as a nurse and a midwife throughout northeast Victoria. I then undertook further studies and a Master of Public Health and then a doctorate in medical science, and worked in research, teaching and administration right across the northeast. It's been a very difficult 3 years. There's no one in this room who hasn't been affected by the events of the last 3 years. We started with the worst bushfires in history. We've had a global pandemic, and here in the northeast, we felt this even more with the closure of the New South Wales-Victorian border. It's brought me, I've worked very hard to stand with you, beside you, and advocate for you throughout that period. And now that we're at this stage, I know that here in Benalla we're facing considerable challenges. We have the worst housing crisis we've ever experienced. Houses 25% more expensive than they were 2 years ago. We have a rental crisis, nowhere for people to find somewhere to live. And we have a jobs shortage, which is compounded by that housing crisis. We also have a climate issue, and I've brought forward to the Parliament solid policies to take us forward and really reap the benefits of a renewable economy. And throughout it all, I've been a fierce warrior for integrity in Parliament. It's why I'm an independent. I'll hold anyone who's in government to account, and I'm proud to be an independent member right now.
Thank you. Our sixth candidate is Ross Lyman. Yes, Ross Lyman from the Liberals.
Good evening. I'd like to acknowledge the Bangarang Nation on which we met today. So my name is Ross Lyman. My background has been in the military and in business. I was in the Australian Army in the Commandos and served over in Bogle, which is part of the North Solomon Islands group. I then went across the UK, went through the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, and spent several years with the Gurkha Brigade operating the Afghan National Army in Helmand Province, as well as out to Nepal. So lived and worked with Indigenous communities, including speaking language, for several years. Since getting out of the military, I've worked in the private sector. I worked for Ernst & Young on health infrastructure projects around Australia and for KPMG on defence projects. I've also worked in the wine industry over the last few years in viticulture, manufacturing, operations, supply chain for companies like Treasury Wine Estates, McWilliams, and more recently with Woolworths. The reasons I'm running for the Liberal Party is around lower taxes and being able to engage the private sector to deliver the essential services we need. It's also around stronger borders and working in our in this day and age, particularly focusing on national security, as well as securing our economic recovery. So for me, when you look at GDP, you know, government spending only makes up 1/5 of that. We've got to look at the private sector, look at consumption, maximising our exports and minimising imports. And that's what I'm about, is growing and building the economy for Australia. Because in doing so, in growing a stronger economy, we can actually deliver the essential services that we all need. Thank you.
We're galloping to the finish. And our final candidate tonight, Stephen Williams from the United Australia Party.
Pardon me. Yep. I'm the father of six. I've worked in many jobs over the years. I've got family ties to the Kiwa Valley, moved up there in 2011. Prior to that, I was in Victoria Police for a few years. I was 20 years in the Melbourne Fire Brigade as a station officer. And in between those jobs, I've had jobs in senior management and also run and operate my own businesses. And I'm currently running a very small mowing and slashing business at the moment. Look, what I want to talk about is the madness of the last 2 years. There's probably no one here who hasn't had someone affected or have been affected. Loss of income, family splits, relatives in trouble. There's just been so much chaos. And none of our politicians have suffered for it. None of them have lost money, have anything. In fact, most of them got pay rises. And yet, here we are. Most of us have done it hard. And what we want to do is make sure it never happens again. We need other constitutional and legislative changes to make sure that they can't shut us down. It could take all forms, a Bill of Rights, many things, but we need to make sure that we're free again and they can't take it off us. We also have policies that cost $1 trillion the federal government spent to get us to where we are. Only the UOP has a plan announced to pay it off, and we can pay it off. And if we don't, our kids are going to have heavier, bigger interest rates for a lifetime. They probably won't afford their houses when interest rates start going up. We really need to get on top of these things, and the UOP has extensive policies for all of this. And thanks. I hope I wasn't angry.
Well, thank you to all our candidates. Now, rest assured, we have had so many questions. We've had volunteers sort through them, categorise them. So we will get through as many as we can. Each candidate will have 90 seconds to respond to each question. So the most commonly asked question was regarding climate change. And I'll leave the... I'll leave the question here for when you come up and stand. The first question: how will you, your party, work to minimise the effects of climate change and transition to renewable sources? Should we still keep? Are you happy to keep going with alphabetical order, or would someone like to volunteer to go first?
We just take it in turns. If we start...
Okay, start with...
First Nadia.
Nadia,
we'll go along and then come back.
That's what I was thinking. Okay. And you have 90 seconds.
Go. These are two different questions, because for me, I think the way my party will do this is not as much as the way I would like to do it. So we have a $20 billion plan to rewire the nation, which is essentially an infrastructure plan that will put $20 billion into making sure that renewable energy can move from the regions into the cities where it's needed. So that's going to be a massive game changer, and we essentially need to move to a fully electric power system as quickly as possible. I would like to see a lot more done. So a 43% renewable energy, emissions target by 2030 is not high enough. I think we should be double that. But I think the fact that we've got this number has actually been very useful in giving us a place to aim. And I think if we are able to put in place all of the Labor policies around a lot more renewable energy, most of the jobs from renewable energy are going to be in regional Australia. At the end of the day, if we can put those in place, we're going to beat the targets. The issue we've got at the moment is there's no plan, there's no national plan. We need some kind of national plan that brings everything together and helps private and public partnerships work together. There's a lot more to be done on water. We don't have a national water plan. We don't have a national agriculture plan. All of those things work in tandem. So I want to see a lot more done on climate change. Labor is the only party that will get into government and do it.
Just joking to Helen that I should just take a minute's silence. It's almost ridiculous to have to depend. But I will say something. There is no cheaper power that has ever been on planet Earth than solar power in Australia today. Per watt. You want to build a bit of nuclear? Have a chat to Finland. I've been there. Their nuclear plant is 10 years late. Cutting edge. 10 years late. We haven't got the time. If I wanted to mess with Finland, if I was Putin, I want to mess with Finland, what would I go for? You try and do that to the solar farm down the road. It's reasonably invulnerable. I've got the town's battery in my driveway and 60 kilowatts on the roof. I'm laughing. The military have been to see the battery. Why are they interested? Why is it that former heads of military see and identify climate change as the most pressing national security issue? Wake up. As a business owner, I want to buy all my staff electric cars. They don't have to go 500 kilometres, they can go 200. Wouldn't that free up a bit of cash in the family? Half of the cars sold in Australia are to fleets. Where's the conversation? Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for a terrific question. Well, climate change is actually the greatest opportunity we've ever had for regional Australia since the Gold Rush. The opportunity for us to transition to renewables is one that can reap us enormous benefit if we get the policy levers right. Throughout my term, I've worked really closely with communities right across Indi and across regional Australia. Together we put to work a policy called the Local Power Plan, whereby we could, with the right investment from government, set up renewable energy hubs, community energy hubs right across this nation, and assist communities just like Benalla to generate their own energy, to share that energy, and to truly benefit from it. Right now, every year in Benalla, $35 million is spent on electricity and fuel. Imagine if we were generating that electricity here and charging our vehicles with that electricity, the money that could be circulating in our economy. I've put legislation to Parliament that would include a home battery in the government's solar panel rebate scheme. That was a scheme that was put together by John Howard. We need to bring it up now into this century and include home batteries because storage is a missing piece in this whole story. I want to see that happen. I know that you do too. It's good for the economy. It's good for the planet. And it's good for those future generations, as Ben pointed out before. That's what I want to see. That's what I'll fight for when I return to Parliament.
Thank you.
Okay, as a member of the National Party, I'm really proud to represent rural and regional areas. And one of the critical things why I joined the Nationals is to manage transition. So I've experienced a millennial drought as a farmer, and you as townspeople understand the impact of a drought when farmers aren't spending money.
That's all? Hold it down the bottom.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay, ready, set, go.
So, you know, in the most recent budget, the Nationals and Liberals in government announced record funding, over $1 billion, to help manage that transition.
I didn't mute it that time.
Okay. We have it. I'll stop it again.
Okay, here we go.
Testing.
We have
a battery. It's so topical, batteries. So let's move on to managing transition. The next is investment in technology. There was a stage where solar panels, PV panels, was a novel technology. Now we accept it. I have a friend whose business is making the solar panels for the hydrogen test plant in Melbourne. There are hydrogen powered buses afloat in Queensland. It's happening. Talking about the batteries that the independents asking for funding assistance from the government, it's a bit of a tricky one because they're, you know, very expensive, at $15,000. So, you know, the average person, when we're talking cost of living, can't necessarily afford that. Also, as far as transition, there's baseload power. We need reliable baseload power to augment the investment in renewables. Finally, renewables are made out of metal. They're exported to China, refined, manufactured in China, and it comes back. We're exporting our emissions, but you need metal to make them.
Right, you probably won't like this that much. The UOP hasn't got any official policies on climate change, so I'm speaking personally. And personally, we've been told for 40 years that we're on the edge of climate doom. It's always sometimes weeks, sometimes a few years away. It hasn't happened. Look, it may or may not happen, but I'm not convinced it's man-made. It could be natural. However, if you want to go down the renewables road and all this, got to remember where these renewables come from. A lot of the lithium and cobalt and other things are mined in the Congo and other third world countries. It's often been said it's used child labour. The processing and manufacturing the products in China is thought to use slave or indentured labour. Now look, personally, I'm not happy with that. I don't want to use a product that's got that. So what I would ask is that any product for these technologies that's made overseas or sourced overseas is subject to an ethical and environmental audit completely, the entire chain. And only then should we adopt those technologies.
Thanks for joining us, Brian. Well done. Right, so at the beginning I told you that the Liberal Democrats are an in-between party. So what we acknowledge, of course, that PV solar panels are fantastic. I have 40 kilowatts of solar panels on my practice, and I haven't paid a power bill since we put them up. But the sun is only up for half the day or thereabouts, sometimes even less. So you do need baseline power. So the Liberal Democrats, in a middle-of-the-road problem-solving type of attitude, have decided that the nuclear power is still the cheapest, safest, and easiest way for us to get baseload power, because that's what you need. Eventually there will be batteries, but you've heard about some of the problems with batteries and rare earth minerals and sourcing them. But the way the Liberal Democrats approach this question, like we approach all questions, is to find a workable solution. So the Greens are very passionate, and I admire that, and we support the decrease of damage to the environment generally and the climate specifically And the way that we say that we would do this is by using nuclear power for baseload energy.
So I have two young children who live in Wangaratta. They're 6 and 7 years old. And touch wood, if they get through to the next century, as per their life expectancy, I don't want them to live in a world that is 2 degrees warmer. My brother, he worked in Antarctica through the 90s as a field guide with the British Antarctic Survey, and he'd taken scientists out, and he spent 3 years down there. And even back then, as I was growing up, he was writing letters home, he was talking about the impact on climate change was having on Antarctica. And I grew up in that generation that had Clean Up Australia Day, that was conscious about CFCs. I've had solar panels in my house for the last 8 years. So in terms of my own personal approach, it's something that I am passionate about, and it's something I want to leave. And at Benjamin's point, if we want to leave a legacy, we need to be able to consider this. The Coalition has a plan, and it's technology, it's not taxes. It's working with the private sector to deliver that baseload power. It's working with latest technology to, you know, even solar and wind are mature technologies. How do we subsidise? How do we get the, as I said before, how do we get the private sector consumption and getting our exports up, getting our imports down, and actually being able to deliver a sustainable solution, sustainable in terms of economic. We grow the economy, we can deliver the essential services we need. There are 16 offshore wind farms that have been approved, 4 in Victoria alone, that can deliver the baseload power. 100% of that is through European pension funds. So it's working with the private sector, it's working with technology to make sure that the private sector can deliver the solutions we need to get our carbon emissions down.
Thank you, and I really do appreciate your people's time. That's great. So I'm really impressed with this. It shows that how much some of you have really engaged with this federal election campaign. The next question, with the most in that category, is an integrity commission with teeth. Many Australians are concerned with the integrity of our federal politicians. What do you propose to do about ensuring strong integrity and accountability in Parliament? We're going to start that in and go back. Is that all right, Russ?
So, as I said at the start, I operated in both the Australian and British armies, and in those roles, we were entrusted with a lot of having to operate with integrity, whether it's rules of engagement or understanding what our limits were. And we've seen how that's played out. If you step outside of those boundaries, how the judicial system works. We've got a number of organisations and committees that look at holding politicians to account. We've got the Expense Oversight Committee, we've got the Australian National Audit Office, we've got the Australian Federal Police, and a number of other organisations, the Commonwealth Ombudsman, that hold politicians to account. The Morrison government has actually drafted a 300-page bill and had over $50 million allocated to a federal ICAT. And the issue about this is that you're innocent until proven guilty, as per our judicial system. And I think an alternative to that means it is guilty until proven innocent, and it means a kangaroo court. But in terms of holding our parliamentarians to account, I absolutely support that. As I said, there's a number of committees already and officers that make sure that happens. Could we go further? Absolutely. But we just need to find that balance to make sure they're innocent until proven guilty. Thank you.
Just try and sneak in there, Tony. So the Liberal Democrats have considered this question, and it is one of the things that we address under personal freedoms. So the question here is balance. So there are some of these organisations have extraordinary powers, and their hearings take place behind closed doors. So someone is marched in and something happens and we don't know what it is, and there are some findings which sometimes we are not even told, but there are consequences for people. So this is a matter of balance, and the Liberal Democrats' policy on this is that we would not have secret hearings. We would not have any closed hearings. They would have to be open. We support appropriate commissions, of course, and of course, and I have to say that the judicial system is working well. We've had several politicians jailed recently, Obeid and another chap. So there's no doubt that when criminal activities take place, the judicial system works. So we would support an ICAC or a similar body, but we do not support secret or closed hearings. Yeah. We like open and transparent justice.
I'm much on board with Julian and Ross. Basically, the trouble is it is open to abuse if you do have an ICAC. There's a need for one, however, it can get out of control. I don't know if you're aware of the case of Margaret Kinnean, the prosecutor in New South Wales, hounded merciless, having trouble saying it. Anyway, she was hounded, and it was. They just get a set on people sometimes. And as I say, the kangaroo courts in many ways, there's no open hearings. You have to prove your innocence rather than they have to prove your guilt. There is a need for one, but a lot of thought has to go into how it's set up and how it operates. Thank you.
Thanks very much for raising the issue of integrity. I'm sure it's important to you all because we're sick and tired of the argy-bargy that's going on. But one thing that I really am concerned about is whistleblowers, because when corruption is alleged, how do you find out that it's actually happening? We have all the protections that Ross talked about. We had the other points that Julian and Steve have raised. But, you know, one thing I'm conscious of is mud sticks. So I'm concerned that unelected officials with more power than the people that are elected can use that to throw mud. And whether someone's innocent or guilty, that person's life is ruined, their family's ruined, and so on and so forth. So we need to be very careful. One thing I do note, though, is that when the Morrison and the Liberals and Nationals in government and Michaela Cash was working on that bill, the reason it was delayed was due to consultation. And I also note that the Independent has been campaigning on that with great pride, and I commend that. But I also note not being part of a team, despite being a technicality, that didn't get up. So I think you really need to be part of a team working together with adequate consultation, with consideration of all the issues to do this successfully and adequately.
Thanks for the question. Well, we've all seen how working with the team and consulting on an integrity commission went for the Morrison government. In 2018, Scott Morrison promised the Australian people that under his watch, he would introduce a federal integrity commission to the federal parliament. More than 1,200 days later, the parliament now prorogued no integrity commission. 90% of Australians, when asked, want a federal integrity commission. Every state and territory in this nation have an anti-corruption commission or federal an integrity commission of some type. The federal parliament is the only jurisdiction in the nation that does not have one. Why does this matter? Well, the Australia Institute, the World Economic Forum have done work on this. It costs $76 billion over a decade to GDP, lost to GDP, due to perceptions of corruption. Right now, this nation has $1 trillion of debt, and we're seeing government members spending public money, $9 billion in North Queensland, to buy seats rather than spend money for public good. I've introduced the Australian Federal Integrity Commission bill to this parliament. It has been supported by multi-parties in the parliament. It is a strong body. It's one that's been lauded by every judicial expert in the country. It is no kangaroo court. It has all the protections that we need. It's fit for purpose.
Thank
Well said, Helen. Our stance on integrity is mirrored by Helen, and in 2010 the Greens introduced an integrity bill to the Senate. The Greens do not take dirty money. The Greens are the only party that aren't paid by... I'm sorry, Nadia, we're mates, but... big business has polluted our politics, and people, the young people, don't have faith in our politics. The Greens, I'm happy to say, don't take money from big corporations. If that isn't an underlying representation of integrity, what more do you need? Thanks.
So Labor is the only party in this election that has pledged to introduce a federal integrity commission by Christmas. So if you want one, you need to vote Labor. We are the only party that has done that. We have one. We have a model ready to go. It mirrors a royal commission. It will be able to look at past events. It will not be a kangaroo court. It will be a transparent process with the ability to hold public hearings. I'm pretty sure I'm the only lawyer in the group here today, and I'm an ex-police prosecutor. Margaret Kinnean actually moved my admission in New South Wales, so I know exactly how the ICAC works in New South Wales. I was a New South Wales police officer. And I worked very, very hard in that organisation to see the end of corruption. I came into the police just as the Wood Royal Commission had finished. So I am incredibly committed to integrity. I note with great respect Helen's work in this area, but I do also note, even with Labor's continued support for this bill, it could not get across the line. You need a party of government to get this done, and Labor is the only party that is taking that to the election. The other thing that's out there in the Senate right now, Labor has a bill in the Senate which will reduce political donation disclosure from $14,500 to $1,000. So yet another bill that Labor is taking to the election.
The next question regards refugee policy. Australia provides a haven for refugees from conflicts in places such as Afghanistan and Ukraine. At the same time, many refugees have suffered in detention or live in a state of continued uncertainty on temporary protection visas. How do you think Australia could improve its treatment of refugees and asylum seekers? Why don't we start in the middle?
Thanks, Lydia. Great question. I know that there are many people in Benalla who are passionate about decent, respectful human treatment of refugees. Our refugee policy is a disgrace. I think there are so many nations that look to Australia and can't believe that we kept refugees locked up in hotel detention for as long as we did, 9 years. They were just released just before the election, make of that what you will. They were let out of that hotel with no money, no telephone, nowhere to go. This is the Australia that historically, after the world wars, welcomed refugees to this nation. This is a nation where Ross fought in Afghanistan and where refugees have come to this nation seeking our compassion and our support. We need to get rid of temporary protection visas. We need to provide certainty for the people who are here so that they can get on with their lives and contribute to this nation as so many other migrants have. And we should never, ever put people in offshore detention. It is a travesty against human rights. We need to treat refugees and asylum seekers with respect and dignity and provide a safe haven and a fresh new life.
So Australia has a very generous refugee intake. We have 13,500 humanitarian refugees come to Australia every year. In addition to that, we've got 16,500 Afghan refugees that we've welcomed because they're very helpful whilst we were over there. And we've also got the temporary humanitarian visas for people coming from the Ukraine. We do our fair share. I have interesting chats with my children about this. You know, the word illegal is problematic sometimes because obviously asylum seekers are not illegal. But, you know, I talk about the people stuck in the Red Cross refugee camps in the Middle East, in Syria, 3 years, eating rice, lack of education, their kids can't go to school. And I really want those people who are doing it really hard and you know, are being looked after by the Red Cross to have access to come to Australia. And push and pull factors are really interesting. One of the reasons we're really tough on boats is we don't want people dying at sea. One of the chats I have with my children as well is, okay, so if someone's escaped Sri Lanka or Afghanistan and they've got to Indonesia or Syria and they're in Indonesia, have they escaped that situation that they're running away from? They have. But what's interesting is their rights in Indonesia are not the same as Australia, and they jump on a boat and they can die in a leaky boat. So we need to balance the push and pull factors, and we do look after refugees.
Thank you, I'll be brief. Look, I think the system we've got works pretty well. It may not be fair, nothing's ever going to be fair. As those other people have said, there are millions and millions of these poor people all around the world. We can't possibly accept them all, and they'd all love to come here or somewhere like this, and we treat the ones who get here fairly. However, the system we have does work, and remember that all these people, as unfortunate as they are, that you, me, and every other taxpayer has to help them. And it's charity from us, but the government is spending our money to make the charity. So look, I think we should just stick with the existing system. I really can't see anything wrong with it. There may be a few tweaks to it. Thank you.
I was awarded the Humanitarian Overseas Service Medal by the Australian Government for my work with refugees in Rwanda. I've worked in East Timor as a medical officer, supporting operations over there with an ANZAC battle group. I've worked throughout Africa with refugees. I've worked at Rumbalara recently, the Aboriginal Health Service. I've thought a lot about these questions, and I'm very sorry, but there is no easy answer. I understand when you look at people who are suffering, you don't want them to suffer. But sometimes the things that you do can make things worse in the long run. And I'm sorry about that. But if you offer too much aid and make people dependent upon your aid, you are not helping them. It is bloody awful to lock people up when they get here after they've come here by boat. But the reason we do it is because we don't want people coming by boat and dying. Refugees come by other means, then they are put through a much better process, and Australia welcomes many refugees and we provide well for them, but there is this stance about boats because we value human life. So there is no easy answer to this, and anybody who says that they can answer this in a fashion that is going to solve all of your concerns is not being truthful, and I have the experience to tell you this.
Julian's right, there is no easy answer to this. This is one of the most complex policy areas in global international diplomacy. But I wish it was a lot more compassionate. And you know, as a person that has worked in the law my whole life, I do not understand why we think it's okay to lock people up for an indefinite amount of time for something that they've done when they've done nothing wrong. There's no law that's been broken here. There is only a desperate person trying to get a better life, and they've actually managed to get on a leaky boat to come here knowing full well that the chances are they'd die making it. So I don't understand why we then put that person in a prison for as long as they can stand it, as long as we can stand it. These people have only been released because there's an election coming up. Labor's policy is to get rid of TPVs. Labor's policy is to turn back boats where safe. And, you know, look, I can see the point of that. We don't want people coming to Australia by boat. Fair enough. But this idea that there's people sitting in Indonesia and Malaysia eating rice, and that they're not the same people that got on the boat in the first place, that is just wrong. They are the same people. These people have just got sick of eating rice, and they've been there for 10 years, and there's no hope for them, and they think, I'd rather die in the sea than stay where I am. So we need a far more compassionate, much more internationally legal way of doing this, and I fundamentally believe that Labor will do it.
So I've worked, as you know, overseas in Nepal and Afghanistan. I'm particularly passionate about the Nepalese community as well as the Afghan community. I was fortunate enough to have one of my main interpreter make it out to Australia in 2012 as an asylum seeker. His family came out thereafter, and he's led a really successful life. And that was under a TPV. Another interpreter we're working hard, he's here, and we're working hard to get his family out here as well. They've made it across to Pakistan once the Taliban recaptured Afghanistan. So it's something I'm passionate about, but 99% of asylum seekers make it here via aeroplane, not boats. And even though that is a highly motivated around the boats, there's obviously work to do. So my stance is we need to make sure Australians here now are protected and safe. And you see the impacts on Europe with uncontrolled borders and the impacts of people who've gone through massive conflict and then being able to take those radical ideas through Europe and seeing the impacts there. That's the starting point for me in Australia. What we can do, if we can shorten processing times, if we can make it, as some of the words have been used tonight, compassionate, then absolutely. You know, I think we should do everything we can to process and make sure that for those that made it here and we want to integrate them as part of our fantastic society that we've got here, then we should do everything we need to do. But the first thing is to make sure that the rest of us are kept safe. Thank you.
Thanks, boss. It sounds great, however, it's not what you've done. The Greens have a very compassionate policy. It's probably worth pointing out everyone, our friend Dozer here, is probably some form of or connected to a boat person at some time in history. We have built a hydro scheme on the back of refugees. So to pretend that these are other, it's just that it's a convenient moment in history to say, no, this is ours now. You're going to have to fight like buggery to get in. We're going to make it hard for you. We're going to deny you dignity. We're better than that. Australia is a wealthy country. We're generous people. My mother was. I had a very, very good mother. And so I feel I need to extend that generosity. So when my friend goes over to look after, now she's in Rwanda, to look after children in Afghanistan and has to, smuggle herself out, and she says, we need help. Who's there helping them? The Greens are there helping them. The Greens are personally paying to help them, to help these kids that are starving, literally starving right now, while your little kids get fat in front of the telly. Probably unnecessary, sorry about that.
So we're just coming up to 8 o'clock. I think we're going to 8:30, is that correct? Okay, right, the next question. What will your party do, if elected to government, in regards to reopening the Centrelink office in Benalla? Nadia? We're mixing and matching.
I'm totally fine with it, but I'm not cross.
Just want everyone to have a go.
So in terms of the Centrelink services, there's traditionally been a visiting Centrelink service to Benalla. And through COVID, that was shut down. It was serviced by Wangaratta, and that was shut down from a visiting point of view. And now it's moved to a permanent office. My understanding is there is an office in Benalla that provides this service. It's got 25 hours to the bed hours. So there are permanent centres, in my understanding, in Shepparton and Wangaratta, and there's visiting services that worked in the past. And obviously I'll consult and engage with the community as to what the needs are to support that. But ultimately, it comes down to needing to grow the economy, make a stronger economy, then deliver the essential services that we need.
Okay.
So I'm pretty aware of the Benalla Centrelink issue, and I found out today that the Benalla NDIS office is now closed as well, permanently. In case you didn't know, because they didn't tell anybody, they didn't do that. I've been working incredibly hard with the Benalla Labor people to raise this issue over and over again. I brought Bill Shorten up here to talk about it, the Shadow Minister for the NDIS and Government Services. I've been working on this the entire time I've been a candidate, ably assisted by a group of very passionate Benalla people. I think it's absolutely outrageous that there is no service provision here, particularly now we don't have an NDIS office. There is no office here, Ross, I'm sorry, but there's no service provision here, and people have to go to Wangaratta, they have to go to Shepparton. Fuel prices being what they are, you know, if you've got a disability or you're on a pension, you've got to afford to somehow get there. There's no real public transport to speak of, it takes you the whole day. And you can't just go online. It's not just this thing of, oh, well, log in and it'll all be sorted. A lot of these issues, you've got to go in and see a person that can actually help you. And the login process, the online portal, is actually a wall. It's not a window. You cannot function any way without throwing your computer out the window and trying to get this done. You need real people. We need public servants back in government services, and we need these offices reopened in regional Australia and in Benalla right now.
Thank you. So the Liberal Democrats believe in less red tape, smaller government and lower taxes. So what Nadia was saying about being able to use the Centrelink service is, in my experience, or more accurately, my wife's experience, absolutely true. My wife is a well-educated woman. She is a pharmacist. And when we had our children and we started to use Centrelink services for things that are available to us, she was unable to use the Centrelink services, even though she has, even though she is a graduate from the University of South Australia. So I'll say that again. My wife, who is a university graduate, is unable to use Centrelink services. She would spend hours trying to figure it out because of this absurd red tape that impinges on everybody all the time. The problem with the red tape is it costs money, and that is why your offices are being closed down, because there is this unnecessary complication of services which are expensive and take away from actual provision of services. And I agree with Nadia that you need somebody that people can talk to, because there are many people who have troubles with literacy and they need a face.
I didn't know until I was in the car coming down that the Centrelink office in Benalla was closing. That seems absurd. It's closed. Because we weren't told. I'm not informed. The Greens' position would, of course, be a little more progressive. And you call it red tape, but it's not. It's an instrument to deny people service. You've done that. Your party has done that to this otherwise affluent society, because they like the rich to get richer and the poor to stay poorer. That's it, on so many levels. I don't need to say anymore.
Funny enough, I agree with Nadia with most of what she said. I think she's done a wonderful job trying to get the office open again. Centrelink's important. The UAP really wants to improve the lot. Do you know one of our policies is increasing the old age pension by $180 a fortnight? And there will be other policies like that too. I believe we need to look how Centrelink works. It's going to cost money, but something has to be done. It is a nightmare to handle. Around here, we live 80k from Albury, every time my brother wanted to see Centrelink, they're trying to send him to the Wangaratta office, an hour and a half away. We'd want to go to the Albury office, and they just wouldn't let us, so we'd have to drive over the hills to get to Wang. And look, I sympathise with everyone. I think we need one, and we need better services for everyone in the country like that. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. During the lockdown of 2020, the local Centrelink regional manager came to tell me that they couldn't staff the office of Centrelink in Benalla because of COVID problems with staffing, and they would set up a temporary office at the neighbourhood house here in Benalla. She then went on to tell me that there would be a period of consultation with the people of Benalla and a new site would be established. I took that information in good faith. I spoke to quite a few people in Benalla, some of them here tonight, and we waited patiently for that consultation to occur. It did not occur. The next thing that happened was the same Centrelink regional manager came to my office and told me, with no notice, that a computer and a telephone would be installed in another office in Benalla. And there would be no staff here. There would be no new staffed office in Benalla. I immediately contacted Linda Reynolds, who is the minister responsible for this. She promised that this would not happen. It happened. The people of Benalla got no say in this. This is a community that has one of the lowest rates of digital literacy and one of the highest rates of social disadvantage. It's a disgrace that this has happened in Benalla. I will fight for this in the next parliament if I have the opportunity, and I'm pleased to hear that Nadia would fight for that too. This is not okay, and I think this is a pattern that we'll be seeing more and more across Australia if it's allowed to go on.
So I love the Nationals because they represent rural and regional Australia, and the question is, did a bureaucrat in an urban area who doesn't understand the local situation make this decision? And Helen's told us that she knew about it. And so then the question is, how does representation from your local member occur? So she's committed to advocate it for in the future, but at the moment it's still closed. My question is, I went to a street walk, went to the Toy World, spoke to the person there. She said she makes her decision about politics, about how her parents are affected. And the key is, it's called Services Australia, and clearly the service needs to be better, particularly for rural areas. And what bureaucrats in Canberra don't understand is that she had to take time off work to take her elderly parents to Wang. They can't use these apps. My husband has trouble with the apps. You know, there's three apps, like the MyGov app, MyGov ID, the Medicare Express app. You know, the process to put my and all my children's and my husband's vaccine certificate onto our phone, that was onerous for me, and I'm tech savvy. How do you expect an elderly person to do that? So I commit to representing rural and regional Australia as part of a party that the Liberals need in the coalition to get that done.
Thank you very much. I think this will probably be our second last question. It's regarding aged care. The government's failed to implement many of the recommendations from the Aged Care Royal Commission. Do you support all the recommendations from the Royal Commission, and will you commit to advocating for the next government to fully implement the recommendations? Can we start with Russ? Is that okay? Yeah.
So from a personal experience, my father, my parents are in their mid to late 80s, my father's 86 and suffers from severe dementia. He requires full-time care from both my mother, who worked in aged care for 50 years, as well as my sister, who's a nurse. So it's something that I see on a day-to-day basis. I think I've been through aged care facilities in the electorate, and the infrastructure is well behind. That it's not fit for purpose. A lot of the CEOs are uncomfortable with, you know, they're pulling their hair out with their own clinical staff and with their own infrastructure and their own allied staff to be able to continue to provide the services necessary. So with the Royal Commission, the findings from the Royal Commission, the amount of investment that's gone into Not only last year's budget, but this year's budget is something that I want to take forward, particularly when we look at our aged care services, be it Wodonga through to Alpine Health, down to Mansfield, and right down here to Benalla. So again, something that personally impacts me and something that has been impacted by over the last few months as I've got around all the aged care facilities. Thank you.
I'd like to know when looking after old people became aged care and it's not nursing homes. Because as soon as we did that, and how we did that, as soon as we privatised looking after our old people, we capitalised suffering. We made profit out of suffering. So as soon as that happened and we made it cheaper to feed old people dog food, what do you think they did? So Labor wants to put nurses back in nursing homes. We've pledged $5 billion to make sure that the Royal Commission recommendations will be enacted. We fully support them, no problem with them. We want to see a registered nurse on duty all the time in old people's homes, in nursing homes. I grew up calling them old people's homes because it's where old people lived. They didn't survive and then die, which is what we kind of look at aged care as now. So Labor has a compassionate policy. We want to see them eating proper food. We want to see people in nursing homes getting nutritious meals 3 times a day. We want to see the right amount of funding, public funding, going to public services. We need to be looking at unprivatising these things. This is a service. It's a place where people go to live out their days until they die. It's not a business, and that's where we're at the moment. So Labor's got some solid policies on this. Anthony Albanese's been very vocal about it. If you want to see change in aged care, you're going to have to vote Labor.
Well, I'm concerned we're talking aged care, but it's specific to the recommendations.
My policy with aged care is actually ageing in place. I'm sure many of you know couples have been married 50 years. Somebody has to go to a nursing home. Finding a nursing home close to home is difficult. And it's interesting, the comments about it being private enterprise. If you think about most of the aged cares, there's St John's in Wangaratta. I'm sorry, I don't know the one off by heart in Benalla, but I've been there. A lot of them are run by not-for-profits, particularly religious-based like Lutheran and so on and so forth. So ageing in place to me, though, is critical, and that is about home care packages. And the difficulty in rural areas is having the service providers to fulfil those home care packages. In addition to that, we need to pay aged care workers adequate remuneration. That's a consideration for the Fair Work Commission. However, we know that those workers have shifted to NDIS. So, and there's not enough workers in the pool. We also know that Labor's policy, they realise there's not an RN. Excuse me, can I pause? Okay. We know that there's not enough RNs, and so Labor's policy was to import them as for the skill shortage in the interim to getting people trained. That leaves those countries, particularly developing countries, short of their own very skilled staff. Be mindful of that.
I had the great opportunity of being on the board of the local aged care in Yakandanda for a couple of years. I got to see, this is during the Royal Commission, so I agree with Nadia when the board has to argue over what brand of cornflakes they can afford to feed our revered older people. I wonder what sort of country the government for the last 10 years has formed, and before that. You know, we can do better. It's a real travesty to the dignity of our older people. The average life expectancy is between 2 and 3 years. You go there to die. Arguing over cornflakes, that's all I want to leave you with. Yes, the Greens will support every recommendation in the Royal Commission. Thanks.
Probably
obviously, I, as a doctor, I've worked at Rangeview and St John's and St Catherine's, and I have a family member who I bring down to Estia sometimes, and sometimes she stays in Rangeview in Wangaratta for respite. I am intimately familiar with aged care and the nursing homes. The reason we call them, we don't call them aged care old people's homes anymore, is my youngest patient in a nursing home is in her 40s. So that's why we don't use that sort of language. It excludes people. The Royal Commission's findings should be implemented, and the reason they should be implemented is because we spent a lot of money and we spent a lot of time trying to get to the bottom of these problems. And the thing that seems to paralyse government is that they think that if they implement the findings, they are there forever. And the way to do it is you implement all of the findings and you see which ones work. And this is a general proposition that should be followed for any substantive investigation. There is never an excuse not to at least trial the findings of a commission like this, and they should all be implemented.
A really important question. The simple answer to the question, do you support all the recommendations from the Royal Commission? Yes. It's not often that we have a Royal Commission report that has a one-word title. Do you remember what it was? Neglect. I don't think there's any Australian who feels comfortable with 65,000 people on the home care waiting list, people who've been assessed as needing home care. I don't think there's any Australian that feels comfortable when they read the findings of the Royal Commission and hear about, the disgraceful diet that many people are given, if you could call it a diet, and the lack of adequate care. What I do know from visiting very many nursing homes and from being a director on St Catherine's Nursing Home is there's also excellent care. I was at Cooinda last week or the week before. Excellent care. The reasons those nursing homes have excellent care is because there are nurses in them. We know, as has been pointed out tonight, that when people go to residential aged care, they only spend, on average 2 years there. Most of their care ends up being palliative. If you don't have a registered nurse to administer palliative care, people are left in pain, people are transferred to emergency departments, and they die on trolleys. I acknowledge the work that Julian has done as a medical practitioner. We rely so greatly on our GPs to care for people in residential aged care, but they can't do it alone. We need to implement all the recommendations.
Again, I agree with most of what our other candidates have said. We will, the UAP will implement all the recommendations. As Julian says, they should probably be reviewed from time to time to see what works and doesn't work. If anyone does know a nursing home feeding people dog food, I would advise them to report to the authorities. As for staff, at the moment, my wife just got re-registered as a nurse after 7 years out. $10,000, and it took us 6 months to find a course. We could make it easier for people to get registration or subsidise it a bit, because we do have a lot of nurses here who drop out for one reason or another, and when they see what it's going to cost to get their registration back, they go elsewhere. That's one thing we can do. Thank you.
Now, before the last question, can we agree what order we're going to do?
I think first.
Liz, you can go first.
In this, equity,
fairness. No, I'm not. So, it's 17 minutes past 8. This will be the last question. It's a shocker. How important is spending on Australian defence, and how much should Australia be spending? Should be spending on its military capabilities. Liz.
I think we can all agree spending on defence is important. So Solomon Islands is topical. I listened to a really interesting news article where China has built a three-storey, very, very large compound in Solomon Islands. They're calling it an embassy, but it could be otherwise used as a base, but not called a base. Obviously, we've got the Ukraine, and we are providing millions of dollars of support to the Ukraine to assist the Ukraine. So clearly, defence expenditure is very important. It is in our recent memory, because of our age group, not mine, but some people's, Darwin was bombed in the Second World War. The wars do come to Australia, and we are naive to think that it never would. You know, the reason the Pacific Islands are so topical is that they are a channel towards Australia and New Zealand and the Southern Pacific. Why was Australia attacked in the past? We have a lot of resources that other countries want, put simply. And again, I reflect back on why we're all here in the first place, our democracy. We are one of the most robust democracies in the world. We have free speech. All of us here have a slightly different point of view, but we're all here. And that must be revered and retained and looked after with our defence.
Now, either one of you two has to speak, otherwise I'm going to have to separate you because you won't stop talking. So, Nadia.
I've been last twice, but I've been second like four times, so I don't know, it's because I'm right here. How important is spending on Australian defence and how much should Australia... Okay, I don't know the answer to how much we should be spending on Australian capability, and I'm not sure any of us do. I mean, even Ross, who's been in the military for a long time, probably doesn't know exactly how much we should be spending. But you know who does? Experts who are not being asked by this government. So we've had, I think the last defence white paper was during the Gillard government. I don't think there's been one since. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ross. We have the most bizarre material, defence material spending policies. We have a bizarre Commonwealth procurement policy that requires the Defence Force uniforms to be, half of it to be made in China. So for me, the issue isn't how much are we spending, the issue is how are we spending it. Who are we listening to make sure we're spending it on the right things? The fact that we aren't going to get submarines for potentially decades is kind of problematic considering we're the biggest island in the world and we probably need a decent navy. But so we've lost all of our public servants. We've lost a lot of our expertise in how we actually figure out defence contracting, which is unbelievably complex, having done a bit of it myself in government. We need to be not looking at what percentage of GDP we're spending on defence. Really, that's an irrelevant question. The question is, how do we get the best possible defence force with the best possible equipment?
Who hasn't gone last yet? Okay, righto.
So spending on defence is relative to GDP. The Morrison government has committed to getting to 2% of GDP. And it's really important to understand because through the ancestry that we relied on the US to provide our air and sea defence. And that's why we focused on our land capability, all your soldiers, your tanks and your artillery. That's changing now under AUKUS, the agreement we've got with the UK and the US. I went to a lunch a couple of weeks ago with Sir Peter Gosgrove. And he said, he had a great quote, he said, someone else is writing the playbook, we must prepare accordingly. And what we've seen, one of the reasons I put my hand up for the Liberal Party to run as a candidate, you know, is what I saw in Afghanistan, a country where we served in for 20 years, and it was overtaken by the Taliban in a couple of weeks. So for me, that's incredibly personal. I mean, what we're seeing with the Ukraine invasion, and the sovereign nation being invaded by Russia for the first time since the end of the Second World War in Europe, we've all seen the footage on TV, that is real. And now what we're seeing, 1,700 k's off the Australian coast, in the Solomons, an area I've served in as well, and you see the Chinese and their expansions in the Indo-Pacific. That's something we need to take seriously. So for me, I agree actually with the procurement. I think for me, sovereign capability in defence manufacturing could be upped, and we actually see more defence manufacturing being made in Australia. The US has 100% of their defence material manufactured in the US, and I'd love to say have that as a starting point in Australia, which would mean jobs and growth in the northeast as well. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. My understanding is both the Coalition and the Labor Party support 2% of GDP on defence spending, but I take Nadia's point. We don't really know, and we've seen real problems actually with defence spending when we look at the submarine deals and the issue that we have right now with no submarines in the foreseeable future. I also just want to take up that point by General Cosgrove, others write the playbook. I mean, most recently, of course, we've had the issue in the Solomon Islands where we were actually given the heads up in August that there were issues with the Chinese government making an offer to the Solomon Islands. Now, we all know that over the last 3 years, the Chinese government have been more aggressive in their policies, not only to Australia, but more broadly. We've seen impacts on our trade, for one thing. I think that is a real concern, that our government have been asleep at the wheel when it comes to what's happening in Solomon Islands. And I think that we need to look very, very closely at not only how we do protect this nation, but also how we do procure the arms that we need, the uniforms that we need. Right here in Benalla, we have Talus, which is a significant industry and job creator here in this area. And down in Wangaratta, of course, we have the mills that can produce the uniforms for the Australian Army. But I'm not doing that.
So that's Brux Mills in Wangaratta. Used to make all the uniforms. They don't make very much anymore. And of course I would agree with anyone who would have defence manufacturing within Australia. It would be lovely to spend nothing on defence, but that is not the world that we live in. And we are being exposed to that in a very direct way at the moment in the Ukraine. We will always have to spend more money than we want because Australia is so isolated and because we choose to partner with our Pacific Island allies. So we don't provide defence on their behalf, but we engage with them and we try to extend our influence. Obviously that's failed recently, but it is something that we must continue to do. We must continue to engage with our neighbours, and all of these things cost money. I think that we will be spending more on defence in the future, unfortunately, and I think it will be growing to 3% of the GDP. I wish it wasn't so, but I think that it is a wise investment.
Everyone's looking forward to the Greens candidate talking about them. believe it or not, I was accepted as an officer. And then I had an old friend, he's carved it now, Peter, who was a prisoner of war. He looked me in the eye and he said, war is a silly business and had nothing to do with it. There is more people enrolled in the Chinese army than there are men, women and children walking around Australia. So we definitely need to have, you know, a strong and competent military, but saber-rattling to our largest trading partner is a great way to kick up a stink. You know, we can invest I'll have to jump up and stand for the party, sorry. We can invest a lot smarter. As part of my business, I stumbled across I worked with a firm that were laughing at a special material order, steel order, that had to be a specific from one specific mill, and they were laughing because it was like 10 times more than a similar material they could have used. So there's obviously massive savings to be gained for, you know, much better return. Yeah. But I'm not an expert.
On the defence, the UOP has committed to getting, as soon as possible, even if they have to lease them from the US, 6 nuclear-powered subs. Whether you like it or not, we need them. If one sub stationed up near Singapore, it could block all of Australia's economy for weeks and weeks on end. We're also committed to expanding the Defence Force, but sensibly. Unfortunately, up to now, a lot of stuff that has been built or made in Australia has been made to create jobs rather than to create a product. We need to do both. The subs in South Australia was just a terrible idea. Never going to fly. So we want a good, solid defence. We're willing to pay for it and we'll take the steps. We also have to be as independent as possible. Do you know the Australian Strategic Oil Reserve is actually kept in the United States? Yeah, we don't keep it here. Now, how are we going to get it from here? A lot of it's in crude oil too that has to be refined. So we have to send it somewhere, refine it, then get it back here. We need subs, we need a good Navy. All the other candidates recognise that, and the UAP is committed to it.
Now, that conveniently does bring us to 8:30, but it has been suggested that perhaps some people who've travelled a long way would like to go for another question. So how about we do a hands up? Not what the push is. Hands up, who would like me to go to one last question? Who's counting? Okay, who wants to go home? One more question. No, you don't get to vote on the question, otherwise we'll be here all night.
Right.
Okay, that was one of them. I shall do that. What is your stance on the... It was as many as the other questions. There were about 4 questions that had 3 questions each, and one was the cashless credit card. Eliza?
There was no new questions on business and tourism.
There weren't any more than... 2 on it. I'm sorry. A count was done of all the questions and they were put into categories and there weren't sufficient.
You can always come up and talk with us after.
Yeah. How's that? We'll go with the cashless card because there were quite a few on that. What is your stance on the cashless welfare card? No, but we've done it now. Come on, Ross.
My experience with the cashless debit card is up in the Northern Territory. I actually worked in a number of remote communities up in the Territory and did some pro bono work with Ernst & Young on looking at this exact issue in terms of the impact it had on certain, you know, remote communities. So for me, I can see the benefits that are brought into these communities. For me, that's my personal experience, but again, you've got to take all of these. We have national schemes, but you've got to take consultation from a community by community basis. And so in some communities it works, in others it's problematic. So again, for me, it seems like it works in some communities, but again, we've got to take a tailored, bespoke approach and have you to consult, you know, as widely and legally as possible with the impact on each community. Thank you. The benefits actually allow. Where I've seen it work well is meaning that you can actually access the essential services you need, the goods you need, rather than actually having the cash in that particular community that might be used for other things that don't actually benefit the individual. So in that instance, I've seen it work really well. But again, you've got to take on a community by community basis.
Julian.
So the cashless cards are obviously far from perfect, and they appear to target particular demographics, which is not the intention. So the idea, of course, of the cards is to make money available for the necessities of life, for food and health spending, sanitary. And to lessen spending on alcohol and gambling and the other things that cash allows. I would be the first to agree that the system is not perfect, but I look at it as a trial, and I think that it has substantial benefits. And I think that this is one of those cases where people who are against the scheme are very vocal, and the people who benefit from this scheme are the people who are often stood over and marginalised. So I don't ever expect to hear great things about this scheme, because the people it benefits are not people who are going to stand up and trumpet it, whereas the people who are disadvantaged by it are the sort of people who will decry it and claim that it is not working. I think that on the whole, it works.
Just on these cards, look, I believe in human freedom and responsibility and autonomy, and nobody should tell you how to spend the money, all right? If you make poor decisions, live with them. Don't come crying about it, though. But to tell people what they can and cannot spend their money on takes away their dignity. It's an affront to humanity. And the next step will be, whether you like it or not, a digital currency where the government control what everyone spends their money on. This is just a start. So, no, I'm against them.
So firstly, I'd like to address the elephant in the room. The Liberal Nationals government had zero intention of introducing a cashless debit card for pensioners. So if you've heard that, it's a mistruth, misinformation. I just want to reassure people that that's not the intention. Talking about cashless debit cards, my understanding is that it's mostly used in Indigenous First Nations populations, and it has benefits, but it's also problematic. So, for example, you can only go to one grocery store, and that limits your choices. And if that grocery store, being in an isolated area, has very expensive groceries, it does really reduce your discretion. So I can see there's problems there. I can also see that some of those communities had really disappointing and terrible social consequences related to alcohol abuse and potential drug abuse. I'm not suggesting that it fixes it, but some of those communities wanted to limit the use of alcohol. And it does seem unfair, I'll talk to this lady over here, that, you know, why should this white person that lives in a lower socio-demographic area not have one, but this person does? I can see it needs improving, and certainly it needs engagement with the populations that it is used for. I've got time, sorry.
Thank you for the question. I was in the Parliament when the Coalition sought legislation to extend the use of the cashless debit card. I looked at the evidence. There was several studies undertaken, one by the University of South Australia, that showed that there was no evidence that this card was successful in curbing people's problems with alcohol or drug abuse. What I would prefer to see is proper investment in support services with people who do suffer from addiction to alcohol and drug abuse. Unfortunately, the government had the numbers, and despite the fact that there was no evidence, that trial was extended to other communities. It clearly is discriminatory in what communities are chosen. Some people have told me, who are on the cashless debit card, that they like to use it. Other people do not. So I think what would be a much fairer approach, or a much more sensible approach, would be to have an opt-in if people chose to have a cashless debit card. But ultimately, we need to use the evidence that's out there and formulate policies that are evidence-based and work to solve the problem that we're looking to solve. So I'm not in any mind, if the opportunity came again, to vote for the extension of the cashless debit card, because there's simply no evidence to support it.
Why don't we start with
a treaty with First Nations. Why is that so damn hard? White Australia, why is that so damn hard to say thanks for allowing us to be here with you on your land and drink your water? What's held us back? What are you afraid of? It's about time. Make it happen.
I've also been working in the Northern Territory a good 10 years ago now, nearly, and saw the cashless debit card. It's a fairly broad question because we're not really talking about a cashless debit card. We're talking about the in-due welfare system, right? That's what everyone's worried about. And I've read the legislation that Helen had to vote on, and there is nothing in that legislation that stops the government from expanding this system to everybody on pension, anyone on a welfare payment at all. Right? So they may be going to the election with no intent, but the legislation allows them to do it. Yeah. Labor will definitely be getting rid of the in-due card. That's one of the platforms on which we're going to the election. In terms of how a cashless debit card works, I agree with Helen. I think, you know, if, and certainly up north in an Aboriginal community, my research was in domestic violence. I spent time with Indigenous women who told me that the debit card helped them with humbugging, which is where family members will come and get money off them. And so now they're able to feed their family, etc. This was a very small group of women, and I absolutely honour their experience and their desire to stay on the card, right? But it's all about giving people choice. A government should never be able to say, with one hand, here's money because you're doing it tough, and on the other side, take it because you're not allowed to spend it the way we don't like it.
Okay.
So Labor will get rid of the in-due card.
Well, that takes us to 20 to 9, so we have gone over time. As the candidates have said, you can go to speak with them individually. They all have tables set out for you if you have further questions you'd like to take. I thought it was a really good, informed debate. I felt we learned things about the candidates we didn't know. I thought everyone dealt with it really well, and they were very respectful. And I'd like to thank you all for being respectful too. I know there's some degree of frustration at not getting through all the questions, but we did diligently work through them, group them, and go with the most similar questions with the highest number and work back through that. So thank you very much. It's past my bedtime. I should turn into a pumpkin any second. Enjoy. Is the bar open? Enjoy a drink and have a chat with the candidates. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed that episode. Until next time, goodbye.